Now stay tuned for To Your Health on WPVC LP Charlottesville, the show where food is on the table and center stage. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Now here's your host, MC Blair.
Good morning, good morning. MC Blair here, and we are bringing you To Your Health right here at WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, Resistance Radio. Now, the first thing I like to do always is headlines. So, I've got one here. It says, Monsanto Tribunal. Monsanto has violated human rights to food. And they also call this ecocide, which is a violation against our earth. By the way, happy Earth Day, everybody. And, you know, it's so important. People, they get these politics going, and they think this is important or that's important. And you know what's important? The earth, food security. That's real important because, let me think, last time I checked, if we don't have food to eat, I think we die, right? Isn't that how that works? Yeah, last time I checked. So they, Monsanto violated human rights also to food, health, and a healthy environment, and the freedom indispensable for independent scientific research. They're trying to stifle scientific research because when scientists get a hold of something, they generally stay on it until it's done. And when they found out that Monsanto lobbies to have that research stifled because it shows the truth about what they're doing, then that's just wrong. It's called ecocide. It should be recognized as a crime in international law. Human rights and environmental laws are undetermined by corporate-friendly trade and investment regulation. Corporate-friendly. Yes, sir. As long as those corporations are making money, folks, who cares who we kill? Well, that's what they're doing to us. That's the Western diet, unfortunately. And now, in Europe, they have tremendous regulations against GMOs and pesticides and herbicides. And Monsanto is doing their best to get those removed so they can poison Europe too. During the hearings that took place in The Hague in October of 2016, the judges heard testimonies from witnesses all over the world who testified how Monsanto has violated human rights and has committed crimes against the planet by aggressively promoting its products, lobbying politicians, and attacking independent scientists. And based on these testimonies, and considering both existing and international law and ongoing legal initiatives aiming to improve the protection of human rights and the environment, the judges concluded that Monsanto has indeed infringed on the public's rights to food, health, a healthy environment, and the freedom for independent scientific research. So that's what's going on, guys. And it said that based on these testimonies and considering both existing international law and ongoing legal initiatives aiming to improve the protection of human rights and the environment, the judges concluded that they had, in fact, infringed on those rights. The tribunal is also of the opinion that international law should now precisely and clearly assert the protection of the environment and the crime of ecocide. If such a crime of ecocide would be recognized in international criminal law, the activities of Monsanto could possibly constitute a crime of ecocide. In their final conclusion, the judges highlighted the current imbalance in the international system, which offers much better protection to corporations and their financial interests through trade and investment law than it does to human rights and the environment. There it is, folks. That's it. It's like, oh, yeah, well, you're just a little guy. You're not a big corporation. You're not a CEO or a billionaire. Oh, and by the way, Roosevelt, FDR, stated clearly and often that the billionaires of this world are the enemy of the people. And that's true. In most cases, that's absolutely true, because all that they care about is the bottom line, making money, and we don't care what the little guy says. So they wanted to, they said it is now crucial for the United Nations to act on this widening gap that's between the corporations and the people. They warned, as otherwise key questions will be resolved by private tribunals operating entirely outside the UN framework. Well, maybe that's what they need. You know, private tribunals. If the UN won't do it, we'll do it. The Corporate Europe Observatory, Nina Holland, welcomed the tribunal's outcome. The verdict of the Monsanto tribunal has our fullest support. Its legal opinion makes it crystal clear that corporations like Monsanto violate our right to live in a healthy environment, and how they get around the international laws meant to protect people and the planet. See, those laws, the laws are in place, and how they get around them, well, that's anybody's guess. Lots of attorneys, loopholes. With the current wave of mega mergers in the agribusiness sector, the biggest pesticide producers are becoming even more powerful. But so is our call to regulate them. Resist, folks. Resistance Radio, right here at 94.7 WPVC. I have another study to show you. It's it links diet soda to higher risks of stroke and dementia. Well, you know, it's funny, folks, but years ago, I mean, I'm talking, gosh, 25 years ago, there was a doctor on the air that I heard when I was in Virginia Beach. By the way, all the Virginia Beach folks out there, big shout out. Woody, I hope you're listening. Anyway, this guy, Dr. Dean Adell, he pointed out that the diet sodas, many of them at the time and still are, were sweetened by a product called aspartame. Well, now, aspartame converts to wood alcohol in your system, which then produces formaldehyde. Now, gee, that's what I want running through my veins, formaldehyde. Yeah, and even at low doses, it will kill you. Kill you. So the problem is that the word diet on the can, they found that many people would, instead of drinking one or two regular sodas, because it said diet, they would drink five and six and eight and more a day. And many people who do diet find an increase of headaches, because it attacks your neurons, and it's bad. Now, they said in this study, Americans trying to stay healthy have abandoned sugary drinks for diet drinks in droves over the past few decades, on the theory that the latter is better than the former, that diet is better than the original sugar drinks. Now more evidence has emerged to refute that. Indeed, a new study shows an association between diet soda and both stroke and dementia, with people drinking diet soda daily being almost three times as likely to develop stroke and dementia. This included a higher risk of ischemic stroke, where blood vessels in the brain become obstructed, and Alzheimer's disease dementia, the most common form of dementia. This was Matthew Pace, who's a Boston University School of Medicine neurologist and the lead author of this study. While emphasizing that the study did not show causation, only a correlation. Well, yeah, let's put poison in our body and see what happens. He said that diet drinks might not be a healthy alternative. Yeah, no kidding. You know, he is a scientist, so they can't definitively say after, you know, this one study. But it described only as a hypothesis by its lead author was surrounded by caveats. While the risk was greater, the absolute numbers were low. In our study, the lead author said 3% of the people had a new stroke and 5% developed dementia. So we're still talking about the number of people with stroke and dementia. He said that participants were overwhelmingly white, and it's possible that ethnic preferences may influence how often people select sugary or artificially sweetened drinks. They did mention that the people who were drinking one or two of the sugar drinks drank four to five of the diet because it said diet, and they felt that that was healthier. So, unbelievable. So we're here trying to limit type 2 diabetes and childhood obesity. And we tout community-based agriculture as a way to do exactly that. Now, I had an interview. I interviewed Tanya Denkla Cobb, who is the director of the Department of Environmental Negotiation at the University of Virginia. And so we're going to play that interview today. It's about 20 minutes long, 28 minutes long. And so we will be playing that. And here's the beginning of it. We'll play it about 5 minutes of it for now, and then more later.
Hey, MC Blair here, and I had the honor of talking with Tanya Denkla Cobb, who is the director of the Institute for Environmental Negotiation. The tagline is empowering communities to create shared solutions. So, the community food system planning, I know you do that, one of the things. What does that entail?
Well, so first I think you have to ask yourself, well, what the heck is a food system, right? I mean, people today understand words like a transportation system or mm-hmm. housing, but still today a food system is kind of this weird beast that people aren't sure what it is. And it's just really simple. If you think about everything that needs to happen to put food on your table, that's part of the system.
True.
So it's everything from breeding and growing out the seeds that are then planted to the farmers who are planting the seeds to then the reaping and the harvesting and then the packaging and the transportation and the storage all the way to then selling it in the stores or whether it's retail or wholesale distribution. And then it also includes how we eat. So it includes do people of all incomes and all race and color and age, does everybody have access to healthy, affordable food? And then the last part of the system is the waste. So what are we doing with the food waste? And so it goes full circle from seed to compost, right?
Understand. So the access to good, healthy food, we're talking about healthy food, folks, not stuff with 19,000 ingredients, but we're talking about, I like to call it real food. Some people call it eco food, biodynamically grown, organic, a lot of names out there.
Right.
But we're
right.
basically...
Clean food.
So access to that kind of food kind of falls under food justice, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Well, food justice, there's another term.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a group here in Charlottesville, the Charlottesville Food Justice Network, mm-hmm. that started with probably a handful of organizations that came together and said, let's try and figure this out. And now, I believe there's 20 or more organizations that are represented.
There are. Yeah, I was looking at them. Just amazing. You guys got to Google that. The Food Justice Network. Charlottesville, a lot of really good organizations and really good programs are part of it, of which you're a part of it.
Right.
Yes, exactly. Now, you were talking about planting and all that sort. You've written two books. Or at least two books, maybe more, I think, actually.
Well, they're still remain secret for the moment. No,
and the first one was The Gardener's A to Z Guide to Growing Organic Food.
Right.
Enlighten us.
So that book is really what I would call a potting bench book. Mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. not a pretty coffee. Well, it is beautiful. I love what they did with it. And there's a beautiful, beautiful drawings in there from an artist who was up in Maine. But the book is really intended for people who want to garden. It's not a coffee table book.
Right.
So
a working book.
It's a working book. I did it. Originally not to make a book. I did it for me because I was going to be doing something I really was far out of my competence.
I needed a plan
right. And I had no clue what I was doing, and so I was trying to organize information so that I would be able to find it easily, and it led to a database kind of thing.
Wow.
Back in the dark ages before we knew the term database. I was showing somebody this printout of dot matrix, you know, like
of course.
About a foot tall.
Yeah, yeah.
And she looked at this, and she was running an organic U-pick farm in Harpers Ferry. And she said, oh, my gosh, you need to publish this. And, of course, you know, the publishing is in my family.
Oh.
And And one, my mother and stepdad ran a self-publishing firm on medieval and Renaissance text. So I figured if they could do it, I could figure something out.
And we'll have more of that right after the break. So you are listening to Your Health here at 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. So we are To Your Health, WPVC 94.7. Happy Earth Day, everybody out there. And we are playing an interview with Tanya Denkla-Cobb. She's the director of the environmental negotiation out there at University of Virginia. So we will get back. She was just talking about a book that she wrote, A to Z of Organic Farming, your organic garden. And here we go. Back to Tanya.
So I did.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
I went down that path and had a ball.
Man, well, that's something that can people get that? I mean,
they can get it. Mm-hmm. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. You should be able to get it anywhere.
Oh, wow, that's great. The A to Z Guide to Growing Organic Food. And that's really, really important, I think. I think you should have an organic garden. At least, obviously, if you just have a garden, you're not going to go out and get a certified, you know, pay all the money and fees. But at least you know that it doesn't have glyphosate or any of that other stuff on there. So,
right, exactly.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I mean, while about a third of the book is on organic pest remedies, and I routinely consult it every summer when I have my few pests, the reality is that I don't do a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's as hands off as possible. And the reality is that if you are following the principles of organic farming, of sustainable gardening, that you will likely not need to do too much.
I've heard that.
Yeah.
I've heard that. And another book was called Reclaiming Our Food, or How the Grassroots Food Movement is Changing the Way We Eat. So is that like programs like City Schoolyard Gardens or Urban Agriculture Collective?
What I've tried to do in this book is to give examples from all across the country, geographic diversity, whether it's urban, rural, suburban, whether it's Native American, Hispanic, I've tried to give examples of projects all across the country of how people from the grassroots are taking control in a way of a part of their food system and are changing people's lives. And so much of this, I want to tell you, is working with children.
Mm.
And so, what City Schoolyard Garden is doing here is near and dear to my heart because I think they are changing lives.
Yeah, well, we had Jeanette Abinader and Aline Carey on the show, and they were just really great. What they're doing over there is really fabulous. It just keep going, guys. You really know what you're doing. Now, what my next question was elaborate on what motivated you to write it, but I think you just told me.
Well, there is a bit of a backstory that's interesting to Charlottesville.
Okay.
Is that Will Allen had come here in 2008 or 7
to
do the ribbon cutting for our first urban farm.
Yep.
And he gave a lecture at PVCC, I think, on how he was using compost in his greenhouses in Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee, right.
I remember.
He used a grant he won a big grant.
Yes. And he got the Genius MacArthur grant, right? Well, he is a genius. And here he is giving slides about how he doesn't expend any energy to heat his greenhouses in Milwaukee. Mm. And I'm sitting there with my mouth open, jaw on the floor, going, holy cow, this is amazing. Holy compost, rather. And I went up to him at the ribbon cutting and I said, you know, would you be open to the possibility that in my next edition of this gardening book that I've got, that I could have a chapter on what you're doing with compost? And he looks at me, he goes, you're a writer? And I said, well, maybe. And why do you ask? And he said, well, you know, we still need somebody to write up our story. And I said, are you kidding? Nobody's written up your story? I said, oh, I would be so privileged to write up your story. So we talked over we corresponded over the next few months, and I started to put a proposal into my publisher. And Will basically said, please do not make this about growing power. Make it, I want to be part of the array of good work being done in the country. So I scratched my head and said, okay, let's do that. Let's make it about what everybody in this country is doing at all different places. And he figures prominently. His project is one of the key projects in the book. But
yeah,
that's the backstory.
That's fabulous. Wow. And then in case my listeners didn't know, Will Allen took some greenhouses that were existing in Milwaukee that had been abandoned. They were there for the inner city in the 20s. And, you know, I mean, so people then knew, gosh, this is how you feed the city. We'll do these green. And, of course, you know, time went on and they were dilapidated. So he reinvigorated those. He gets the inner city kids in. And they are proud of it. They get the food for their families, and he's really doing a lot of good up there.
Right.
And a little bit more on that right now. We've got, said, meet Will Allen, the urban farmer, starting his own revolution. This is food justice, folks, at its finest. So when you think of farming towns, Milwaukee proper might not come to mind. The large Wisconsin city is perhaps better known for its famed breweries and picturesque location along Lake Michigan. But one resident has a mission to make farming more accessible, even within the city limits. Now, Will Allen was a former professional athlete. He played basketball throughout college for the University of Miami, also in Belgium. He's held corporate jobs and spent 21 years in a completely different profession. Now, urban farmer, he co-founded a group called Growing Power. It's an urban farm, and he teaches people in urban Milwaukee how to grow not just food, but good food. The organization's sustainable farm features multiple greenhouses, indoor and outdoor gardens, crops, and animals such as goats and chickens. Growing Power also hosts workshops and outreach programs and distributes its produce, meats, and products throughout the city, making a big impact on the lives of many. It says, we're only 6 blocks away from Milwaukee's largest public housing project. When people drive by the street and they see the greenhouses on the front, they have no idea that we feed 10,000 people from just this farm. In particular, Allen enjoys working with area youth. The work that he and the children do, he explains, isn't just about farming. It's about life. And that goes back to what Carter Wallace was saying, guys. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, To Your Health. Right here on the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, Resistance Radio. And we will keep resisting people like Monsanto. I was talking about Will Allen And we are also talking to Tanya Denkla-Cobb, who mentioned Will Allen in her interview. And I was talking about what he was doing and working with the youth. We had Todd Niemeyer of Urban Agricultural Collective of Charlottesville with the community gardens that he oversees. And both he and City Schoolyard Gardens mentioned that when these kids get in the garden and start working and realizing that they can grow good stuff, good food, and then they get to take it home and share it with their families, they feel better about themselves. And when you have people from different income stratas, different cultures, and different colors of skin working together, well, they end up finding out, hey, this person isn't so bad, or that person isn't like my parents, or you know, somebody on the TV said that they were. They're just like me. They're good people. So you have more of a symbiotic relationship between different cultures, and that is the road to peace right there. That's it, guys. So you can have world peace through good food. Not a bad idea, right? So he said it's more just learning than learning to put a plant in the ground. It's about learning some life skills in terms of how to take control of yourself, how to take care of your body, how to be able to work in this environment. It's about learning how to eat healthy and be able to build things by doing something hands-on. And this is great. This gives the kids something really important to do where the family benefits from it. And I know that an extended time of this practice, that type 2 diabetes and childhood obesity will go down. That will save the community costs on health care. I mean, my gosh, you know, just wake up, guys. That's all we need to do is get this word out and get more people in the garden, even over the summer. So we'll go right back to Tanya and more of her interview.
And one of the things that he said that really struck me, I mean, I met so many fine people, so many amazing, inspiring people. And what he told me, I've never forgotten, is he said, you know, Tanya, is you have some inner city kids who have never put their hand in the soil before, and you bring them in here and you tell them to put their hands in that pile of compost. And he said, it's like everything kind of dissolves, you know, that he said the ADHD kids, they get grounded. And I just thought that is so powerful, that this is a connection, connecting kids to nature in a way that is helping them to deal with the stresses of their lives. And there's nothing more powerful than that.
You're so right. I talked to Todd Niemeyer at UACC, and he says the same thing. Yeah. You know, these kids that have never done it, and all of a sudden they're getting grounded and connected with nature, and they get excited. And the families, they're saying, oh, my goodness, you know, this is way better than TV and video games and all the stuff that the kids do today. And it's family. It brings families together. It's just really fabulous. And, oh, by the way, that book was named one of the top 10 books on the environment in 2012 and won the Nautilus 2012 Gold Green Living Award.
Isn't that cool?
That is so cool, man.
I was so excited.
And it just said, you know, and
who knew?
Who knew? Those are important validations, you know? That's really, really neat. I've always wondered, you know, Thomas Jefferson had gardens, obviously, in the, you know, in the 1820s when he, you know, started his university, and there were kitchen gardens all over because that's what they did, you know, then. And some of that's been lost. But now I understand that you guys plus others in the university have gotten together and you're kind of starting these kitchen gardens again? Or?
Well, we have a kitchen garden down at a place called Morven,
right.
Which
right.
was donated to us by Mr. Kluge.
Oh, okay.
A huge, bucolic, beautiful old estate. And the students are running a quarter of an acre garden, and they are running a CSA from what they produce, and people on faculty and students can purchase shares in the CSA. But more importantly, I think that they are a place for students to have a different kind of connection with their world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's allowing them to have a window into a different way of being while being at this high-pressured, stressful university.
Right. So, I mean, do you see maybe eventually, I mean, UVA has a lot of land. That people don't see. I mean, if just driving around, they're not going to see a lot of the land that UVA has. I've always said, gosh, get possibly some land use grants, put up some gardens and greenhouses, even raise meat, possibly.
Yeah.
I think you would have
You're waving my magic wand.
Oh, goody. Oh, good. This is awesome. Because, I know that Mayor Siner is on board with the local food movement. Sustainable movement, and I would, my next step is, what are the steps necessary to secure the endorsement of city council?
Well, I'll tell you, first we need the endorsement of the UVA Foundation that owns these pieces of property.
I see, right.
And that is the group that needs to be convinced. Now, let me tell you, is that this idea of using the Kluge Estate down at Morven and possibly other lands, this has been circulating.
I'm sure.
Students have been writing about this since the early 2000s.
Oh, my.
So we're going on 20 years now pretty soon idea has been batted around. But I think, fingers crossed, toes crossed, I'm thinking that before I retire, that this might actually happen.
I would love to see it. I ever since I got involved with the show, well, actually before that, but more so with the show because I started to focus. I firmly believe that we could probably supply 75% of what we need to eat in Charlottesville.
Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah, that's a lofty goal.
I haven't crunched the numbers, and that would be a great student project, by the way, is to crunch those numbers.
That's true.
And on UVA lands. But I think at a minimum, one of the things that we could envision is turning over the classic farming that's right now being done at Morven, and it's being rented out to a farmer to do, I think it's the soy, corn, wheat, maybe, mm-hmm, rotation, mm-hmm, is to turn that into a more sustainable agriculture production.
Some real food. I'm sorry.
Well, real food that could be given to UVA dining.
Yeah.
So that at a minimum, which is happening at many universities across.
I know. I've been reading about
across
it.
The nation.
Yeah.
And so we would not be paving the way. We would be part of a large cohort of universities that is saying that this could serve a place for research, and it is a place for providing lower cost produce and food for the university. But even if it isn't lower cost, it is still providing a demonstration to our students and a place for them to learn.
Yes.
That's we're listening to Tanya Denkla Cobb, Director of the Environmental Negotiation for University of Virginia. And you're listening to Your Health, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Anyway, so we are right back. How about that? And we are playing the interview that I had with Tanya Denkla Cobb over there at Environmental Negotiation at the university. And I also wanted to do a little bit more of, I wanted to mention the Food Justice Network of Charlottesville and the UVA Food Collaborative. They have the community partners. They have University of Virginia Dining, and that's one of the things that Tanya was talking about, and how they were able to work with Aramark over there, and you'll hear more about that. One of the partners is the Local Food Hub, which is a wonderful organization. They get together with the local farmers and help distribute the food to the institutions, schools, and restaurants. Also, we have Market Central, which is the Charlottesville City Market. I just got back from there today. Over there, bought a couple of chickens from Bel Air Farm. That we had Jamie on from Bel Air Farm last week, and he talked all about that. I also got some wonderful asparagus from Broadhead Farm and Wally and Susan Parks out there. Wonderful, wonderful folks. Also, the Buy Fresh, Buy Local campaign. They help consumers find local products while building relationships between growers, food artisans, farmers, market retailers, restaurants, and institutions. You have the Piedmont Environmental Council. It's a nonprofit working to safeguard the landscapes, communities, and heritage of the Piedmont by involving citizens in public policy and land conservation. That's important. Also, Edible Blue Ridge, a wonderful publication. Actually, they did a piece on Wahoo Q, which was a barbecue sauce that we developed and got it into several places. Pretty good seller. They've got, of course, City Schoolyard Garden is a partner with the Food Justice Network. We've had them on with folks, and then they got the Thomas Jefferson Demonstration Garden, the Charlottesville League of Urban Chicken Keepers, or CLUCK. It's a network of urban chicken keepers in Charlottesville. They also have a page on Facebook. And there's many other partners to the Food Justice Network. And this is so important, guys, to get the word out to as many people as we possibly can, thus making the community healthier. And, oh, by the way, I'd like to mention this. Mentioned Susan and Wally Parks at Broadhead Farm. And Wally, one time, I was talking about something political, and I was ranting on and on, and I looked at him and I said, well, what do you think, Wally, as a farmer? And he thought, and he looked at me and thought again, and then he looked at me right dead in the eye and said, eat more sweet potatoes. So I knew that right there, not to talk politics about Wally. He was involved with important stuff, you know, growing that produce that is just so good for us. And so now when people start ranting to me about politics, I look them dead in the eye and I go, community-based agriculture. If you can immerse yourself in that, helping, it's an investment, guys. It is an investment in the community. We're so caught up in our own personal lives that we just if we would just get out of our skin a little bit and get into the community-based agriculture, whatever you can do, whether it's donating money or donating time. You go to the Food Justice Network, look up some of these partners, see what somebody, you know, these guys are doing. Find the one that appeals to you and volunteer your time. Believe me, they'll accept that. Or at the very least, donate some money, or both. But you'll be so glad you did, and you'll meet new people. You'll be more invested in the community. It's all about investment. Talking with Barrett Hightower out there at SALT Artisans Market on 53, right there on the way to Ashland Highland. You just where 53 bends to the right, boom, it's right there. I was talking to her, and she stressed it. It's about an investment. You've got to invest your time. You've got to invest your money. And that's how we will get this thing done. That's how we can have our own community food system secure and away from corporate influence and really help the people get healthier. That's what it's all about. So Those are some things to think about. We're going to go back to Tanya's interview now, and I'll be back right after that with my two-minute drill.
That is value added.
It is, and then yeah, it could be in concert with other, you know, even non-university programs.
Yeah.
You know that, and I firmly believe in this. That these there's so many programs out there. You let each one continue being run by whoever's running them, but you share information with the other programs, ideas, information, and in that, then they would be together, yeah. but still retain their uniqueness, you know, and
no,
that's
question.
Important.
I mean, one of the things that's happening is the Morvan Summer Institute, where we have interdisciplinary classes being taught, or a number of classes in different disciplines being taught, and the idea for Morvan would be if we could transform it into a sustainable landscape, that it could be a living laboratory for architecture, for landscape, for history,
so awesome.
For environmental sciences. That this is a living laboratory for so many cool classes.
Yeah, I mean, that's, and then of course, you know, obviously research is done and lessons are learned, and then you publish the findings and other people benefit, which is kind of like what a university is all about, you know?
Right, and we get some food to boot.
And get the food to boot at a lower cost, but even more so, the less fortunate folks would have access to that through volunteering, you know, with the gardens and learning. And obviously, you know, when people of different cultures and different skin colors work together on a common goal, all of a sudden a lot of that hate and all that sort of thing just disappears, you know, and and I see that happening.
Well, I think that's a really interesting part of the vision, Michael, that people haven't even started talking about is, you know, how this could be a place for students to rub elbows with student others that they might not normally rub elbows with, whether it's different disciplines, whether it's different race or backgrounds or income levels. When you're out there on a farm working, it levels the playing field.
It does.
Yeah, it really does.
Now, I saw a really neat article, and it was April 10th, you know, in Cavalier Daily.
Okay.
About nurturing sustainability through local food.
Cool.
I believe that was the name of it. There was about local foods and dining halls, which you had told me about with the Food Summit with Tim Beatley and all that. And so we were really, you know, getting in. And you at that time were saying that you were at the beginning of getting Aramark to supply local foods in some dining halls. That was sort of the advent, and now it's happening, right?
Right. So the 2007 was the first Virginia Food Security Summit, and it was amazing. I look back and I go, holy cow, what we dreamed, and we made it happen, and 150 people showed up at that first summit. It was pretty cool. And we had people visioning, and one of the things that came out of it was the need for the Virginia Food System Council, which is still going on. But here we are at the university, let's see, it's 10 years later?
Yeah.
Holy cow!
That's crazy.
And now where we are is we have a sustainability plan for UVA, and food, for the first time, is now a part of the sustainability plan. And as part of the food sustainability plan is we are working with Aramark, UVA Dining, to shift the compass towards sustainable foods. Now, here's the biggest, most exciting news, is that they are under contract that by 2034, they have got to be at 50% purchasing sustainably produced foods.
Oh, that's awesome.
And that will shift the nature of Virginia agriculture.
It will.
And you know why? Let me tell you some numbers.
I want to know.
Is UVA Dining serves, hold on to your seat.
Okay.
It serves 10,243 meals a day. 10,000 meals a day. So students are here for 28 weeks. So that comes out to, they serve 2 million meals in a year. So imagine if 50% if 1 million of those meals are sustainably produced.
Local, yeah.
Which means within 250 miles, mm-hmm. community-based, we will be following national metrics set by a thing called ASHI STARS, if anybody's interested. And there are really clear metrics. And that means that Virginia agriculture will be changed and impacted.
That is so awesome.
It gives me goosebumps.
No kidding. Oh, my God. We've got Professor Phoebe Crispin.
Yeah.
She's the co-chair of the University Committee on Sustainability.
Yes.
And she said one of the, you know, challenges is getting the word out to the students.
Yeah.
And do you know anything about our any plans that are?
Well, yes, indeed.
Yeah. Oh, good. Oh, good.
I don't know that. We are hoping to, we'll see, fingers crossed, mm-hmm. if we can get a survey out to students before the semester ends. We're going to try and conduct a student-wide survey around sustainable food. And part of it is educational. So, and then we're going to try and run this annually to see how things change over time. And to see what their level of interest is, whether with more education, their interest in buying sustainably sourced mm-hmm. foods changes, how much more they might be willing to spend, and all of that good stuff.
Well, yeah. I know that there's a doctor that I've been following, Terry Walls, and she broke it down to all the way to the cellular level.
Wow.
With the mitochondria and how the mitochondria is the energy driver of each cell, and that if your mitochondria are healthy, there are certain diseases, i.e. autoimmune, that are, I won't say you can't get them, but boy, it's really hard, because that's what your mitochondria not being healthy is kind of what opens the door to some of those diseases.
Wow.
Because the cells don't get the dye signal on time. They think they're immortal, and they start rapidly producing more and more cells that think they're immortal. Well, that's, and I checked with an oncologist, that's cancer.
Wow.
Basically, I mean, that's real basic. You know, there's so many different kinds.
Right.
But basically, it's the cells don't ever get the dye signal. They just keep producing. Obviously, if the mitochondria were healthy and they got the dye signal on time, that wouldn't have occurred. And that's so basic. But there have been a lot of changes in things like MS that she's witnessed, Parkinson's.
Even autism.
Autism. The rates of autism.
Yeah. But I know, I am not an expert on any of that. But I will tell you anecdotally that I do know somebody who has an autistic son, and he has said that they found a big, significant difference in the behavior and manifestation of the autism by switching to organic with pesticide-free foods, that the symptoms were greatly reduced.
That's amazing.
Now, that's one anecdotal,
right, that's
story.
Anecdotal.
It's a correlation. I mean, we don't yet have the cause, but there is this suspicious correlation between the changes in our food system and how we eat and this rise in autism and a variety of
things.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I know there's a connection. One, a famous nutritionist back in early 20th century coined the phrase, you are what you eat. And at that time, he said he was convinced that 90% of the diseases that we had were caused by bad foodstuffs. And that was in the 20s.
Huh.
And so now we're really cranking up those bad foods with glyphosate and slow learners. Well, I think it's that taste has now become the benchmark. If it tastes good, I'm going to eat it.
Well, what we hope, well, see, here's the problem with that, is that we are, again, I'm not an expert, but from what I've read, is we are programmed to love things like sugar and salt.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they are tied into our survival.
Yes.
And so when foods are loaded with salt and sugar, is we love them. I mean, that's addictive.
It kicks off the dopamine.
I don't know anybody who can have just one, right?
And it's true.
It's very difficult.
Yeah.
But today, the shift towards taste is different from that, is now the whole, the clean food movement and shift towards healthier foods and whole foods and local foods at restaurants is much more about, because these foods are tastier. Mm-hmm. And so we're learning that tomatoes, which everybody points to because it's the easy thing, we can all know the difference between a cardboard tomato and one that has just been picked off the vine. And what people are finding is that there are differences in taste in meats, in eggs, in cheeses, in how that animal was raised. It affects how the milk tastes. It affects how other things taste. Now, some people can't taste the difference, right, but enough can that it's affecting how they're buying. So that is really interesting.
Is there anything that you would like to get out there that maybe we haven't touched on today?
Well, I think for me, the most exciting thing that I'm working on is really working with UVA Dining, mm-hmm, to shift, to try to help them and facilitate, working with the task force, to facilitate a shift between where they are right now, which is 6.73% sustainably purchase of sustainable foods, to getting them up to 50%, because that is going to have a system-wide ripple effect.
Oh, it will.
And it will change everything that I know about Virginia agriculture. It will change so many things. It will support the local food hub. It will support new farmers, new young people who want sustainable long-term contracts and keep them in business. And so for me...
Yeah, that's huge.
It's just so big, I can't even tell you.
Possibly a drop in... obesity and type 2 diabetes.
Maybe so.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Wouldn't that be? That would be, sorry for the very bad pun, but the icing on the cake.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, well, thank
this
you so much.
Great.
It's
been great. This has really been good.
It's been really fun, and you're doing great work. People need to know more about what's happening in our community.
That's true. We've gotten over 1,200 downloads so far. So
woo-hoo!
We started the show, so that's really
awesome.
That's heartening.
Congratulations.
Thank you, and to you too.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure, for sure.
Well, that was Tanya Denkla Cobb, and what a great interview. She's just a wonderful person. I've known her for 10 years now. It's time for my two-minute drill, guys, and boy, is this is so important. You know, many people think they're destined to be overweight because of genetics. My mom and dad and grandparents are obese and have type 2 diabetes, so will I. Well, that's could not be further from the truth. And I can prove it to you. There's a group of Indians, they're called the Pima Indians. They have two tribes right here on Earth. Both are genetically identical. The first group lives in the Sierra Madre Mountains in Mexico. The second group lives in Arizona on the Gila River. Well, they were separated 700 to 1,000 years ago, hardly enough time for DNA to change through evolution. The Pimas of Arizona are among the fattest groups of people in the world. The only populations more obese are people living on some isolated Pacific islands. On the Gila River Reservation in Arizona, children as young as 6 and 7 are so obese they can't run. They lumber across baseball fields out of breath before they get to first base. I don't know about you, but... Nothing cooler and just makes you just rise in wonderful, wonderful, good feelings to see children running all around and playing. Well, they don't get that. Among the Indians over 35 in Arizona, the rate of type 2 diabetes is 8 times the national average. In fact, the prevalence of diabetes on the reservation is the highest recorded anywhere in the world. By age 50, nearly 60% have type 2 diabetes. Now, what are they eating? Well, like many Americans, their diet is largely fats, sugars, and refined flours. Cokes, cheeseburgers, pepperoni pizza, Twinkies, Oreos. What's their exercise? Not much. Nowadays, their farm, a large collective enterprise, is run primarily by machinery. Most are employed in offices at the tribal government or in the reservation's casino. By contrast, the Pima Indians of rural Mexico tend to be thin, wiry, and strong. They work the land like generations before them, with their hands and simple tools. Their diet consists almost entirely of the foods they grow. Beans, potatoes, corn, tortillas. Wait a minute, they grow tortillas? Huh, what's that, a bush? Seasonal vegetables like zucchini, squash, tomatoes, garlic, and green peppers. And fruit, especially peaches and apples. And once a month, they might get a free-range chicken. On average, the Pima Indians of rural Mexico weigh 65 pounds less than the Pimas of Arizona. Same genetics, guys. In marked contrast to the Arizona Pimas, less than 4% of the rural Mexican Pimas develop type 2 diabetes. And in Mexico, it's found primarily only after age 50. The Pimas in Arizona are developing diabetes in their teens and 30s. The westernized diet of processed foods, sodas, and even organic junk foods like potato chips and brownies are keeping us sick. Big Pharma doesn't help. They just market pills for everything when a healthy diet could reverse those diseases. This is the reason we here at To Your Health emphasize the importance of buying and preparing fresh, local foodstuffs. Join us in supporting the programs of the Food Justice Network. We can do it. We can control the majority of our own local food system, resulting in a community with lower health care costs. Students who have higher performance results. Adults who are more tolerant of other cultures. These are the results of a community who works together supporting the local garden projects and nearby farms. I'd like to thank Tanya Denkler Cobb for her dedication to the local food movement. Well, we're about done here, and we've had a pretty good show, I think. So rock on, everybody, and remember, buying local food and eating sustainably grown food is the key to your health.
You've been listening to Your Health with your host, MC Blair. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Be listening again next Saturday at 11 for To Your Health. The show is produced by Ben Chambers, production assistance from Mike Friend.